Welcome to the Theopolis Podcast. I'm Peter Lighthart, and I'm here today with Jeff Myers and Alistair Roberts. James Bijan, who is normally with us, is unable to be with us today. We'll miss him, and we expect him to be back soon for further episodes of our podcast. Thank you to Brian Motes, who, as usual, is recording, and he'll be editing and smoothing everything out and making it available to you. We are in the middle of a series of studies in the book of Deuteronomy. We are in chapter 23 of Deuteronomy, inching our way through this section of the book as we cover a lot of different detailed laws that come under different headings of the Ten Commandments. As I've said repeatedly, there's a large section of Deuteronomy that's organized according to the Ten Commandments, and they're given in order. And we're currently in the Eighth Commandment section of Deuteronomy, "Thou shalt not steal." And so the sections that we're dealing with have to do with property, have to do with exchanges. We're going to be looking at loans and interest in this episode. I'll be looking at the use of property and the produce of the property and gleaning laws and scrumping laws as we go through. So loans and uses of pledges is another topic that comes up in this section. I want to make a more general comment. I've brought this up before, but I wanted to develop it just a little bit more. Carl Polanyi, in his book, The Great Transformation, talks about the difference between pre-modern economies, which he describes as embedded economies, and the disembedding process that takes place in the early modern period, where the economy is disembedded from other kinds of social and political relationships. And so the point he's making is that in pre-modern economies, economic actors in the marketplace were not just autonomous and anonymous economic actors whose only relation with one another is that of buyer and seller. You don't just have this the kind of relationship we have when we go into a Walmart, pick out our goods, go through the checkout line. We might say some pleasantries to the person behind the register, but there's no real relationship there. It's a purely economic exchange. And Polanyi's point is that in earlier economies, in pre-modern economies, that was not the case. You had economies that were embedded in social relations and political relations and relationships of hierarchy. And part of the process of the formation of the modern economy is this disembedding from those other relations. So the economy becomes an autonomous set of relations. And when we think about the book of Deuteronomy and the economy that's envisioned by Deuteronomy in the terms that Polanyi gives us, I pointed out this out before and several times, that it is an embedded economy, which means that the relations, the economic relations within Israel are not just economic relations. And Israelites are not allowed to treat one another simply as economic agents when they enter the marketplace and when they engage in economic transactions. Rather, they're to treat one another as brothers. And that brother-brother relationship sometimes cancels out or trumps or at least shapes the way that economic exchanges go. We've seen this, for example, in the laws regarding slavery. When you put together the laws of slavery in Deuteronomy and Exodus and Leviticus, there's a distinction made between temporary bond servanthood, which is a relation that you can have with a brother, a fellow Israelite, and permanent slavery, which according to Leviticus 25 is permitted for foreigners. Israelites were permitted to hold slaves permanently and even to pass them on as an inheritance to their children, but not brother Israelites. So this is a kind of economic relation, but it's not just an economic relation. You know, just slavery itself is a kind of interpersonal relation just in itself. But then that's further modified and qualified by this relationship between Israelite and Israelite. We're going to see it in the first instance that we're looking at here in Deuteronomy 23, verses 19 and 20. It has to do with interest, charging interest on loans. And there's an explicit distinction made between loans given to fellow Israelites, brothers, and loans that are given to foreigners. And interest is permitted in the second case when you make a loan to a foreigner, but not permitted when you're making a loan to a brother. You have it in a somewhat different form when you get to the end of chapter 24 and you look at the gleaning laws. There, the gleaning laws permit poor people to come onto your land and to pick up the things that have been dropped in the course of harvest. They can follow the harvesters and they can pick up the stalks that are dropped in the grain harvest. They can pick up grapes and olives from orchards and vineyards. And the Israelites are landowners are not permitted to go back over their property and make sure they pick up every last stalk of grain or every last grape. This is, again, a kind of embedded economy. You can't, if a poor person comes onto your land, you can't say, oh, whoa there, you're going to have to pay for that. You have to recognize him as a poor person. There has to be some way of doing that. How that was done, we don't know, but there must have been some way to identify him as a person who was qualified to glean. But you can't charge him for what he takes from your property. So there's an economic distinction of rich and poor landowner and landless. And that distinction doesn't just get removed when the person comes into the land for gleaning. So Polanyi says that you have this great disembedding that takes place at the beginning of the early modern period or the modern economy. That's never entirely true. I don't think there's ever been an economy that's entirely disembedded. I mean, we still have, you know, family relations within businesses. Nepotism is a constant reality. You have people that take out loans, startup loans from their friends and family and to get businesses started. Those are loans that are given not necessarily because of the high commercial possibilities, the high profit value of the loan, but because, you know, you want to encourage your son or your daughter to get this business going. And so you make a loan. You can enter into kind of interpersonal relations. You become friends with some of the people that you engage in economic transactions with. But still, I think Polanyi is right that there is this kind of abstraction that becomes more of the norm in the modern period than it was before. And I just want to raise a question, see if Alistair and Jeff have any thoughts on this, about how we think about that theologically. One, I've thought of a couple of different angles on that. It does seem like you have something like the market as church phenomenon in a modern economy. So whether you're Jew or Greek, people of every tribe and tongue and nation can come into the market. And as long as you have the kind of token that allows you to engage in that is money or credit of some sort that allows you to engage in economic transactions in the marketplace, that's your identifying mark. That's your kind of sacrament of inclusion. But it includes everybody, and you're making transactions in the marketplace without regard for other kinds of social relations. So it looks like kind of a quasi-ecclesial reality, the modern market does. That's one question. Is that an accurate way to think about it? Is that a helpful way to think about it? And then we can go from that to ask the question, well, is that a bad thing? Could that become a kind of surrogate church, something that replaces the church and competes with the church? And it actually needs to be something that Christians are somewhat skeptical on, somewhat in combat with, because it becomes this kind of ersatz church. Or another way to think about it would be that kind of evening out and equalizing of the market is in fact an effect of Christian penetration of the market. Christianity has transformed the way people do business and the way they carry out their economic transactions. And you have this kind of peaceable marketplace that's made possible by the church on a scale that it wasn't happening prior to Christianity. I mean, there were cross-cultural economic transactions in the ancient world. I'm not denying that. But has the Christianity made a difference in that? I guess that's my question. And could we think about that as the market with its equalizing of economic actors as a kind of achievement to some degree of Christianity and a no Jew or Greek kind of message of Christianity. So I hope that series of questions and reflections makes sense. And I wondered, Jeff and Alistair, if you had any reactions to it.
Here I'm reminded of the work of someone like Benjamin Nelson, the idea of usury from tribal brotherhood to universal otherhood. And I think that subtitle captures something of the dilemma within the Deuteronomic legislation. There is a distinction drawn between those who are outsiders and those who are your brothers. And the significance of not engaging in usury is recognizing your fellow countryman as a brother and not engaging in predatory relationships with him, not engaging in a sort of privatized form of economy, but rather recognizing that the ideal is a society where everyone prospers together. And so if you're engaging in some sort of loan, then you want to ensure that you prosper with your friend or you failed to prosper with your friend. There's no longer a sense of the opposition or the privatization of interests, and the possibility of one party in such a transaction gaining greatly at the expense of the other. And in the history of the Christian Church, there has been a significant shift from this strong taboo within Christian civilizations to the relaxing of the taboo upon usury and the taking of interest. And the movement has been, as Nelson puts it, from tribal brotherhood to universal otherhood. So the tribal brotherhood is articulated in Deuteronomy. The universal otherhood is the situation increasingly we have now. But the universalization could have gone in a different direction with the universalization of a prohibition upon usury. And the relationship, of course, between Jew and Gentile was very much shaped by the actual laws surrounding usury, historically within Europe particularly. And so I think this is a particular prohibition with a fascinating and interesting history. And the role, for instance, of Reformed Christians such as Calvin in particular in relaxing the prohibition was a significant civilization development in civilization. And I'm not sure it was one that I'm not sure it's a straightforwardly Christian development. It's a development within Christian civilization that was a sharp turn away from a previous order, which was also informed by a reading of this commandment.
When you mentioned the mutual benefit that economic transactions, you appreciated the fact that you were benefiting one another. It wasn't just a win-lose, but a win-win situation. It reminded me of Ruth chapter 2, when Boaz shows up to his field or to his portion of the field, and the first words out of his mouth is "Yahweh bless you" to his employees, to his servants, and they respond to him, "The Lord bless you." Blessing, of course, is not just internal and emotional peace; it's wealth. And so it's as if Boaz is telling them, "I would like you to prosper, and I'm here as your overseer, as the owner of this field, in order to see you prosper." And they back to him, instead of being envious that he is the Lord, the owner of the property, and he's becoming rich and he's a mighty man of wealth, he's a mighty man of valor. Instead of them being envious of that, they want him also to prosper. So they say, "The Lord bless you, the Lord make you wealthy." It's that interaction, that personal interaction between, an owner and those that work for him, which is that, it seems to me like, look, the marketplace, there's always been marketplaces, but they tend to be localized in the ancient world. And I don't even, when does that all shift? It seems that technology, and this is something we have to factor in, technology has made it way too easy for us all to engage in economic transactions without personal interaction at all. I just noticed that there was an essay that came out, I guess it was today or yesterday, in a particular Presbyterian denomination about the loss of the offering plate. Okay, so now everybody's giving to church electronically, and that then means that there's no liturgical offering anymore. The offertory, the tribute offering, where did it go? How does that work? You're not coming into the Lord's house anymore with your hands full, and you're not doing it with other people. You're doing it, through technology in an impersonal kind of way. And that's the case with loans. That's the case with loans. That's the case with dealing with poverty. And I mean, honestly, even it's very difficult for us as modern people, even in the church, as a pastor and as deacons and elders in our church, we have someone who's poor that comes to us. It's so much easier just to send him down the road to a food pantry. But at that food pantry, he's not going to really get any personal attention, they're just going to fill up two bags of groceries and give it to them. And I'm confessing here that it's very difficult to engage in these kinds of interactions, whether it's with the poor or the needy, or even in business transactions. It's so much easier to do it through the internet or through whatever technology that allows us to be impersonal. So, yeah, those are my comments.
Yeah, I think, Jeff, just to add a gloss on your discussion of Ruth, I mean, it's an interpersonal relation, but it's also, there's a kind of liturgical exchange that's going on. And that's the context within which you have this owner-laborer relationship. It's overarched by the mutual blessing in the name of Yahweh.
Yeah, and then you mentioned gleaning in that chapter. Ruth obviously is a Moabite. She's a foreigner. But she comes to the field and she works and she is evaluated personally by Boaz. There's a discriminating kind of charity there. Is this woman worthy to be on my property and working? In fact, it seems as if he sees her for the first time later, maybe later in the day, resting, and wonders whether, you know, she's been actually doing her part in this. And so there's that very personal interaction between Boaz and even the poor that are there to benefit from his practice of, you know, leaving the edges of his field unharvested.
Yeah. So that would support my suggestion that there's some way of screening gleaners, that the landowner, I mean, obviously there's got to be, because if you could have somebody that would be disruptive under the pretext of gleaning, they become disruptive of the harvest, or they are, I mean, Boaz talks to his workers about not harassing the gleaners, particularly Ruth. So you can imagine some gleaners would take advantage of a system, or they would be disruptive. So there must have been some kind of process for screening the landowner is still permitting people to come on his land. He's guardian of his land, and he permits people to come on or not.
Yeah, and not everybody is, like you say, not every landowner is following that. I think when Ruth comes back to Naomi with a pile of grain that Boaz has been gracious to give it to her, Naomi says, hey, you stay with this guy. Don't go into another man's field because you might get assaulted there. So there's some personal responsibility. This is one of the questions I had about this. Is in 19 and 20, about not charging interest, whether it's on food or money or anything, how is that enforced, or is it enforced? Or would it just be enforced in terms of like social being socially ostracized? And I'm just curious about that, because it seems like, you know, at the time of, you know, the judges with Boaz and Ruth and Naomi, is that there were lots of owners that didn't even bother to follow the gleaning laws.
Here it seems to be attached to the promise of the Lord's blessing, if you observe this, and elsewhere attached to the Lord's sanction of, or his judgment upon those who act in a way that's predatory. One thing that's worth maybe reflecting upon is whether this is loans in general, or whether it's charitable loans for people in need. The other thing is thinking about some of the economic arguments that have been made against a universal legislation against usury. Things like the fact that money lent at interest has its logic in time preference, that money now is more valuable than money in the future, because you can do more things, you can produce things with that money that make it more valuable in terms of the original capital and what has been produced with it by the time that you might have gained the capital yourself. And so the loan, charging interest on it, there's that sort of logic to it in the context of a business. And so I'll be curious to hear both of your perspectives on whether this is universal against the taking of interest, whether it's specifically on charitable loans, whether there are economic cases within which taking interest would be legitimate under this legislation.
Before we get to that, let me just respond to a couple of things that that you all have said. One is on the enforcement issue. There's no mechanism that's given here. I think you can probably take what Chapter 24 says about the hired servant who doesn't get his wages, and the moral exhortation is underscored by you pay him his wages so that, verse 15, he doesn't cry out against you to the Lord and it becomes sin in you. When it talks about pledges in chapter 24, you don't keep a pledge overnight that the debtor needs so that he will bless you and it will be righteousness to you. So it's the Lord enforcing it, but also the Lord enforcing it in response to the petitions of the people who are being blessed or cursed by the activity of the creditor. So that would be another dimension of, I suspect. I want to reinforce too something Alistair said right at the beginning of this discussion, and that was I think you were citing Nelson, the turn from tribal brotherhood to universal otherhood. And just to reinforce that last category, tell me if I'm getting what he's saying correctly. Israel treats foreigners differently, and they can take interest. They can take the bite of interest from them because they are other. And what Nelson is saying is that's now been universalized. So we can each take a bite of one another, and it doesn't matter whether we're brothers or strangers or whatever, because it's not that everybody is equal, because everybody is equally in the position to take advantage of one another. Is that the kind of point that he's making?
Yes, that's definitely part of it. And then also the way in which this specific legislation, as it got played out in Europe, was very much connected to questions of Jew and Gentile, and also the Reformation debates about discussions about the taking of interest, how Luther and Calvin treated this question. And it's a very significant piece of legislation for understanding European history, and also the way in which the church's position on economics has shifted.
Yeah, just a detail. I don't have the quotations in front of me, but I came across quotations from Calvin in the course of preparing. And although Calvin does make allowances for commercial interest-bearing loans, it's pretty carefully couched. And it's not like he's opening the floodgates to universal indebtedness and abusive uses of credit and debt that we find today. And he's certainly not opening up that, because he's opening up possibility, but he's hedging it in various ways. So he's much more traditional than many of his many successors would have been on the question of usury. Yeah, I do want to go back to Alistair's question, because this is a key question in the interpretation of the passage, is whether we're talking about cases where somebody has become poor, somebody is a brother in need, and that's when you can't take interest. Or what if your brother wants to, extend his wheel making shop and wants to be able to purchase some new tools, and you loan him the money to do that? Is that the same kind of, does law cover both of those kinds of situations? That's one of the cruxes of the interpretation of the passage.
Well, if this is a gloss on Exodus 22, that's clearly a passage that's about charitable loan. If you lend money to any of my people with you who is poor, you shall not be like a money lender to him, and shall not exact interest from him. Seems there is this distinction that being a money lender is not necessarily evil, but you can't perform that function with a poor brother. If ever you take your neighbor's cloak and pledge, you turn it to him before the sun goes down. I think we talked about this earlier with regard to the Jubilee too, in the seventh year, so that charitable loans like this become, after 7 years, you're taking a risk that you're not going to get it repaid. And Alistair was talking about the future there earlier, and how this relates to that. So if you lend this money to someone, you're taking a risk that in the future, when the seventh year rolls around, you're not going to get it back. That wouldn't apply to business loans, I don't think, to loans if you're being a money lender to somebody who wants to buy a piece of land and start farming or whatever. I don't think that would apply to that. Taking interest on a loan like that seems to be reasonable. And if it's true for foreigners, I wonder if it's also true for someone maybe who's not in your community, an Israelite who's passing through with a caravan or with a trade. He's got a trade, and you make a loan to him. He's not part of your community. He's not part of your city, and yet you can do that and charge interest without fear of retribution from the Lord. The Lord's not going to hear him cry out against you because you charged him interest on a business loan.
I think the passage that you referenced there, Jeff, in Deuteronomy 15, verses 7 to 11 is really key. There's a suspension of the sort of economic logic that might otherwise kick in. If you are in a situation where you're lending to someone and the year of release is near, it's not in your economic interest, it would seem. It would make more sense to be limited in what you give to them, to recognize that they're about to be released from burdens of debt, and so you're going to be grudging. But the command is actually, the Lord will bless you as you are open-handed with someone in this situation, and he will make up to you whatever might be lacking and what they will repay to you. And it seems to me that that wouldn't apply to the sorts of economic transactions that you'd have in lending to someone starting a new business. That said, I think that the logic of brotherhood that you see in the case of the poor Israelite would also apply to some extent in those situations of business. You would not be able to engage in sorts of contracts that would have potentially predatory effects, and there would be restrictions upon the degree to which you could profit from the impoverishment of other parties. And so the sorts of contracts that would be entered into would be restricted more broadly, not just in the case of the recipient of charity.
Yeah, I think that I agree with that. And both the distinction that you're making between loans to the poor and commercial loans, and the fact that there'd still be some kind of regulations on how those loans are working, so that you're not taking advantage of somebody who is in a position of subordination. I think that your point about the suspension of economic calculus is correct. Or you could think about it, is this saying the same thing you said, but slightly different terms, that the calculus actually needs to include the promise of Yahweh. So in an important sense, it is in your economic, your long-term economic interest to be free-handed and open-handed and not to demand interest, because the Lord has promised to bless it, and it will be righteousness to you, and those whom you help will bless you before the Lord. So it's in the long-term economic interest even to, because the Lord is the one who's governing and involved in all the transactions.
Perhaps we need to be careful too, not to restrict brothers to just the people that we like, or the people that we love, or the people that are part of our family. It does seem like Jesus almost, well, I don't think he contradicts this, obviously, but he certainly kind of expands it a bit. So Luke chapter 6, if you do good to those who do good to you, what benefit is that to you? Even sinners do the same. And if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to get back the same amount. But love your enemies, do good and lend, expecting nothing in return, and your reward will be great, and you'll be sons of the Most High, for he is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Be merciful, even as your heavenly Father is merciful. Now, that economic calculus there that Jesus warns against is getting money back. Okay, you lend to someone and don't expect to get back the same amount. Doesn't mean you're not going to get anything back. In fact, you're going to actually probably enhance your relationship to those people, or at least even transform it by doing that. But it's fascinating to me that he talks about lending there. He talks about lending twice and making sure that you don't, that you're not too restrictive in terms of who you lend to, even for charitable loans.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the anti-usury argument, is that to use the terms that Alistair was using earlier, that what Christianity encourages is a universal brotherhood in the market rather than universal otherhood. I mean, you could add the parable of the Good Samaritan to that analysis, Jeff. Say, who is my neighbor? Who is the one that comes under this rule for charitable loans? Then it's not just the person who is who I'm connected to by some church bond or some natural family bond or something, but it's somebody who crosses my path and is in need. I think you're right that Jesus expands the demand. Though I was going to also say, Jeff, in response to the comments about the foreigners, clearly charging interest per se is not evil, because Israel is permitted, explicitly permitted, to charge interest to foreigners. That's said in verse 20. But again, the anti-usury argument would be the whole point of that is that you're going to be, as it were, decapitalizing a foreigner, and his wealth is going to be brought into Israel. It could be a commercial loan, but the commercial loan is profiting Israel, not just the foreigner that you're lending to. And so the permission is a permission that's still based on this kind of insider-outsider relationship, and treating the outsider as not as an enemy, but somebody who's you're removing purchasing power from them to some degree by charging them interest.
Do you have any thoughts on the fact that this is situated under the treatment of the eighth commandment, you shall not steal? Earlier in chapter 15, we had similar legislation, the legislation that Jeff alluded to, in relationship to the commandment concerning the Sabbath. And so the principle there would be very much one of liberating, of setting free those who would be burdened and enslaved by debt. And the connection between debt and being enslaved, I think, is a very important one to understand some of these this legislation. But at this point, it seems to, by being categorized under the eighth commandment, suggests something more of a claim or a duty that you have towards someone, or maybe even some claim that they have upon you, that you are defrauding them if you engage in usury with them. Any thoughts on the distinction between the situation of such material under the fourth and under the eighth commandment?
Yeah, that sounds right to me. This may be another angle on it. The language that's used here for interest is intriguing. It's nashak. The verb is nashak, and the noun is used nashak. That's interest in verses 19 and 20, which typically means bite. So you can't take a bite from your brother, not a bite on money, food, or anything that's loaned with a bite. You can take a bite from a foreigner. And I think it's an aggressive term, obviously, but the picture is you loan X amount to your brother. He pays that X amount, but then you take another extra bite from his property, and that's the interest that you're given. It's interesting that comes immediately after the treatment of the harlot and wages of a dog in the previous verse, in verse 18. And it makes me wonder if there's a kind of overflow of the imagery. In verse 18, we discussed that we talked about the dog as a male prostitute. That seems to be what's going on in the immediate context of verses 17 and 18. But maybe there's a kind of predatory concept that's coming over into the next law, verses 19 and 20. And taking a bite from your countryman is somehow being compared to the predatory sexual practices that are condemned in the previous verse. So the other thing that's intriguing is that the word isn't just bite in general. It's typically snake bite. So in Genesis 49, I think is it Dan that's described as being like a viper who strikes at the heels of a horse. And the all of the associations of snake bite, poison, striking at the heels, biting the heels, injuring the heels, that comes out in the terminology that's used here, I think. And you have the overtone of associating those who are taking a bite. Let's assuming that this is a loan to somebody who's in need. Taking a bite from somebody in need is serpent-like behavior. It's satanic behavior. That's all kind of a roundabout way of, I think, supporting the point you were making, Alistair, to why it's included under the eighth word. I want to broaden out the discussion. We can close it down because we spend a lot of time on these couple of verses. I think, as Alistair said at the beginning, this is interest is a huge issue, and of course, debt is an enormous issue. It's an enormous issue, I think, in the ancient world in ways that we don't realize. I've been in preparation. I've been reading through some of David Graeber's book on debt, a history of the 5,000 years of debt. And he covers ancient civilizations where debt precedes the use of money in terms of coinage. Debt is the way the economy operates. You have creditors and debtors that you track credit and debt, and that's the way that the economy works. And money, when it's introduced, coinage, when it's introduced, becomes a way of measuring and a token of that credit and debt. But debt is pervasive in ancient economies. Of course, it's pervasive in modern economies in all kinds of directions. It's you've got obviously commercial debt. That's the way you grow a company, is by leveraging it and taking out loans so that you can grow the company fast enough to sell it off at a certain price, and then you cash out, you pay off your loans, and you cash out, and you start the process over again. So there's a reliance on debt as a kind of entrepreneurial mechanism. Consumer debt is massive. Government debt is almost unimaginably large in the U.S. and I'm sure other countries too. International debt. One of the giant issues between the northern and southern hemisphere, to use a generalization, is a creditor-debtor relation between the creditor north and the debtor south, and the way that those dynamics have worked out over the last few centuries. And not only that, we have debt is a way of thinking not only about our economic transactions and how the economy works, but it's terminology that we use semi-metaphorically in all kinds of settings. Other than that, we think of interpersonal obligations as debts. If somebody does us a favor, then I owe you one. I'm indebted to you. So there's a moral obligation that's imagined as a debt. We have indebtedness and cancellation of debts and payment of debts is central to Christian soteriology. Jesus paying a debt on the cross and releasing us from, tearing away the certificate of debt nails that certificate of debt to the cross and bears it away. So this is a huge question that I think it'd be great if somebody just did a massive tome on a biblical theology of debt with an eye to all the economic issues that are entangled with it.
Or maybe the related issue of gratitude.
Yeah, maybe somebody could write on that too.
Hey, in response to your comments just now, and circling back a bit about what you said earlier with regard to Israel and foreigners and Israel and the other nations, Peter, I just want to make sure, it almost sounded like you were saying that Israel charging interest to other nations, lending to other nations, the purpose was to like decapitalize them or defund them in some sense. I don't think that's what you meant, was it?
Well, that's I was saying that's one of the anti-usury arguments, that it's the fact that it was permitted for foreigners doesn't remove the moral taint of interest, because the purpose of it was I wasn't endorsing that view. I think Rush Dooney says things like that, and I think North says things like that.
Okay.
I wasn't endorsing that view though.
Okay, yeah, because we do have two statements in Deuteronomy 15 and 28, where there's the promise that Israel will lend to many nations, but not borrow. And that is connected, I think, in Deuteronomy 15, especially with ruling them. So it doesn't seem like borrowing and lending and charging interest is necessarily like the zero-sum game for the nations in Israel. So or even worse, it's to the detriment of the nation. It seems like the nations would benefit from Israel lending to them, because along with the lending comes the relationship, and ruling and being ruled. Of course, in Scripture, is not just a power game, not just about authority. So that Israel, in lending and in ruling over the other nations, would also be serving them, would also be enriching them in lots of ways. So, you know, win-win kind of situation here. And I think that even applies in personal, let's say, personal interactions with foreigners, for an Israelite who has the wherewithal to lend to a foreigner, a traveling merchant or something. Even that is not simply an economic, a money kind of thing. It also would, at some point, encourage and enrich relationships. And I mean, it's been said many times before, and I think it's accurate, that Israel being where it is geographically, spatially in the ancient world, everybody traveling through there, everybody's trade routes going through there, in many cases, hey, that's good for everybody. It's good for Israel. It's good for the nations as well.
Yeah, and it's a great point about the blessing that Israel will be a lender nation, and they won't borrow, but they will lend. That's a good larger context to put this particular law in. I'd also want to bring up something else that Graeber said that I thought was intriguing and put a somewhat different light on, you know, what might be going on in something like Deuteronomy 23. He cites an anthropologist who is studying some tribal culture in somewhere in Asia. I don't remember the particular location. We said the huge expenses for the poor were marriages and funerals. So it's not that they're starving to death. It's just that they have occasions in life when they want to splurge, and they don't have the money to do that. And so it was common in this culture for poorer people to take out loans in order to provide the kind of festivity for a marriage, or the kind of mourning for a funeral that, you know, do honor to the dead. That's when they would take out a loan. And then lenders not uncommonly would charge exorbitant interest and would also, enslave members of the borrower family until the loan is paid, or something along those lines. So the picture that I've typically had in mind with passages in the Old Testament is somebody has lost his land. He's fallen on hard times. He's had bad harvests. He's nearing extinction, and this is going to support him for a while. But it could be something that's much more common, but something that he doesn't have, that most people won't have the wherewithal to do. And although, in that kind of situation, it does seem like Deuteronomy 23 would apply. If your brother comes to you and he wants a loan in order to marry off his daughter, taking advantage of that time of celebration in order to enrich yourself seems to be exactly the kind of aggressive economic abuse that Deuteronomy is condemning.
I think it might be worth also thinking here of the degree to which themes of debt and the release from debt are treated within the New Testament. Think about the parable of the unforgiving servant, or the way that we pray, forgive us our debts as we forgive those our debtors. And that can be people who have wronged us, and the burden of blame that we place upon them, the unforgiveness that we hold towards them. But it can also be the material debts that we have, the way in which we can hold people in bondage because of how much money they owe us. And of course, the unforgiving servant being a great example of that. Someone forgiven an incalculable amount of money, who will bring his fellow servant into bondage merely for a trifling amount by comparison. And I think here also of the fact that this is in the eighth commandment section, And under the category of stealing, it suggests that the debt, there are not merely situations of debt and property operating where the debtor owes the creditor and they must pay back lest they be stealing. The creditor also owes the debtor a duty of love. And the commandment that we have in Romans, owe no one anything except to love one another, these sorts of teachings surrounding debt and love, and the way in which, for instance, the Gentiles are encouraged to give charitably to the Christians in Jerusalem as relief, and to give it open-handedly as an expression of their gratitude for the spiritual blessings that they have received, and not to calculate what is owed in return. All of these sorts of things are integral to Christian practice within the New Testament. They're not something that's a side note. And so these principles that we have introduced in places like Deuteronomy are principles that remain, I think, incredibly important for understanding the logic of our faith in the New Testament too. They may not be playing out in quite the same way in terms of laws concerning interest, but they remain fundamental principles of forgiveness, of release, of recognition of ourselves as debtors who have been forgiven. And the way in which we relate to others needs to be informed by a text like this.
Thank you again for enjoying this episode of the Theopolis Podcast. For more information and for more content from Theopolis, you can check us out online at theopolisinstitute.com. We release new articles every Tuesday and Thursday on our blog, so you'll want to make sure to look out for those. You can also find us on Twitter at @_Theopolis and on Facebook if you just search for our name. If you've been helped, sharpened, and encouraged by this podcast, we'd really love it if you would go to iTunes and leave us a review. It just takes a few seconds, and it really will help us along in getting our content in front of new listeners. That's all for now, friends. We really look forward to being with you all again in the next episode. And as always, thank you so much for listening.